walk us through this. You know, you have Saudi Arabia, in which the Crown Prince is, even by CIA standards, responsible for the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi. You have the 9/11 incidents, where you have so many of them who were involved, Saudi citizens. And yet, when it comes to just a thing about oil production, the Saudis won't even help the U.S. out there. How is it that the U.S. is so bound with Saudi Arabia? Why?
I think Trump really answered this question very well when he was a president, and he said that when he was asked in a press conference why U.S. doesn't stop supporting Saudi Arabia, he said in a very concise and accurate statement, he said if we stop supporting Saudi Arabia, it means that there will be no Israel anymore. Today, it's very obvious that Saudi Arabia and UAE and Israel, there is an alliance between them. All these countries think that their security, the security of Saudi Arabia and UAE, is really part of the security of Israel. And U.S. will never leave Israel alone, in the region, especially with rising powers in Yemen, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Iraq. This is, I think, it's taking more of an a regional perspective here rather than a one country problem.
While Hamza Karim was speaking there, Frank Emspach, I was thinking about how the U.S. is involved in this standoff with Russia over Ukraine. You have the situation of the U.S. involved in a crisis in the South China Sea with China. You have the U.S. involved in what we're looking at here in the war in Yemen, not to mention other military engagements. It almost takes one's breath away to think about the military engagements. Isn't the U.S. Kind of thin or going thin on all these?
Well, I don't know if it's going thin, but what's happening is that you are having a narrowing of the discussions here. And you also have a very weak government in the sense that you have a good portion of the population for the first time, a third, who's questioning the very legitimacy of the government. And so one response that has been, tried and true for many, many governments in many, many years is the military option, where you have a situation where there's crises and you have to rally behind the commander-in-chief. I don't think that can be completely dismissed here. But in terms of the Saudi issue, I think the United States has seen Saudi Arabia as the bastion of a politics, an anti-people politics, a politics which is extremely conservative, a politics which favors a certain type of capitalism, and that's it. That's the driver in terms of policy. And I don't think you're going to see much change there. To the extent that the Houthis or that people in Iraq or the people in Syria or the whole Arab Spring challenged those policies, those ideas, that organization of society, the United States was going to line up with Saudi Arabia, and did, and helped support, finance, and whatnot, all kinds of stuff since the Arab Spring to move the politics back to a more conservative, anti-people position, as we did in Egypt.
Final question to you, Hamza Karim, what is your reading into the war games that were held in which Saudi Arabia and Israel were involved with the U.S. and some other, 9,000 people from 60 regional navies, as it said? What is your reading into having that war game at this point? Especially the fact that you have Saudi Arabia, along with Israel, participate in it with the U.S.
The fact that this is happening in the Red Sea really shows us that Israel is really worried about, having the Red Sea under the control of Ansarullah, the government of Sana'a. Controlling the Red Sea means choking Israel, because if you control the Red Sea, it means that Israel doesn't have access to water, or most of the ships that are going from Israel and from around the world to Israel.
Thank you.
Could be under danger.
Thank you. I'm sorry to jump in. We're just fresh out of time. Hamza Karim, okay. Many thanks. Yemeni activist and political commentator. Frank Emspach from Madison, thank you. Emeritus professor at the University of Wisconsin. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Batahway and the entire team, it's goodbye.
We congratulate all our listeners worldwide on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Habib and Sayyid Mohsen. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So today's topic is different of opinion in Islam. Unfortunately, today in the media, especially in the Western one, they show the Muslims as the barbaric, violent ones. The ISIS form of the Islam is shown to the world. So whoever who is different from us, takfir him, excommunicate him out of the religion of Islam, kill him, you know, behead him, or something like that. Is the religion of Islam does not respect different opinions from him because it is a revelation of Allah or it is rooted in divinity?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. I think we should differentiate between state and non-state here as well. Very important that does Islam have its state or not. Now I'm going to talk about the time of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. During the time of Imam Sadiq, Imam Sadiq would come and disagree with atheists. He would debate with atheists. Not one time did he disrespect him or for example order for his killing or stuff like that. And the thing is that when you have this open, you know, debate for ideas, some people truly have questions. They truly want to reach the reality. On the other hand, there are some people who know. They know what the truth is, but they still want to fight the truth for their own good, for their own gains. They're making a movement. Okay. That movement is kind of dangerous. Yes. You have to cut it off. Especially if you have a state, you have a ruling where you're controlling society. Society has to follow these laws. You know these laws are divine laws. These divine laws are the ones that are going to make human beings reach to the perfection or that utopia that all humanity dreams of. And you see someone coming to fight these ideas. When you see that, you have to stand forward and stop it. Mm-hmm. And that is why in some situations when new ideas come that are, you know, with misconceptions,
okay,
we fend them off. Yes. How we fend them off? We write our own books, or we fight them back with, with debates and stuff like that, right? If they continue to come and continue to drive people, and they make their claims personal, and they make their claims and arguments something of making fun of the, you know, of the ideas that we have, it's not intellectual, it's not scientific, it's not academical.
Okay.
During that time, we cannot allow someone to make fun of our religion or our laws. We cannot make our laws something silly or a joke. Our religion is not a joke. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we must cut them off in any means. And you understand
really?
What any means.
Okay.
But at the end of the day, we can have different opinions. We can come and try to talk about these different opinions. What's wrong with that, academically speaking? Do not make fun of others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't reach it to a point where you become Daesh or ISIS. And don't make it to a point where you become France, where you're allowed to make fun of everyone and everything, so-called in the name of so-called democracy.
France, which France you mean?
France.
France.
Good France.
Oui. Oh, good France. Okay. Okay, France. Yeah, I'm looking at, okay, the cartoons you said.
Yeah, I'm talking about the cartoons.
Yes.
They believe in this democracy that you can make fun and do whatever you want. No, it's not like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's something, it's not a game. It's a religion, society. People, you know, we say, saying it is easy, but living it, it's at all different level.
Okay.
We're talking about justice in society. you know, when someone steals, you know, when you hear about someone being robbed, it's not like when someone robs you. Mm-hmm. When someone robs you, you feel it. You feel the need for it.
Yes.
Us, our societies, especially in the Middle East, unfortunately, we feel that need for justice more than any other place. It's not a game of fun and manners. We're talking about religion. We're talking about law here.
That's all right. Especially when you look at the seerah of Prophet Muhammad and the Falun Gong, how they face difference of opinions at the time, or observing the rights of even the non-Muslims on that land. You know,
that's the thing, that so
through the laws.
Unfortunately, okay. some people state that Islam wants to, you know, ISIS want to, because they only saw ISIS. They haven't seen the Shia. I'm talking about this with a burn in my heart.
Okay.
They haven't seen the Shia, the true Shia rule, how it is. Look at Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect example. The Christians are living very well in Tehran. They're very happy. I even know people who are from the Jewish religion living in Qom.
Yes, we have.
We have
deputies in our majlis, in our parliament.
They are living here. They are living here, and they are doing their lives normally. True, they have to follow the laws of Islam. Why? Because it's a religious country. It's a religious constitute. It's law for God's sake. They believe that this law is the thing that is perfect. They believe this law is the correct law.
Yes.
That is why you cannot break the law in America.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot break the laws in America. You cannot break the laws in Britain unless you're in the parliament and you can go party after 12 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're burning in salt in your wounds.
Okay, that's all right. So different minorities are living in Iran, peaceful coexistence, we could see in Iran. They have their own representatives.
They have
in
a church,
parliament.
For God's sake.
They have church, they got Christ's birthday, December 25th, recently, you know, in Tehran. They got it, you know, we have the Kalimis or Asterians, you know, different religions in Iran, and they're living happily over here. So, is really a difference of opinion a bad thing, Said Mohsen?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, difference of opinion is a natural thing,
okay,
which has been given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to
mm-hmm.
everyone. Because
mm-hmm.
if I talk about something, I explain about something, and if I want to ask in a class where we have 10 people, 10 students, to write this thing the way I said, all of them will write the same thing with different ways.
Yes.
So basically, there is a difference. Obviously, everyone thinks differently.
Mm-hmm.
But if everyone would have think about the things in the same way, we wouldn't have any kind of differences,
mm-hmm.
and there was no need of having these governments and all those things and revelations and the guidance, or making even laws. Because
yes.
if everyone was thinking about a peace, or would prefer peace, if it was the case, then we shouldn't have like the corrupt people in the
yes.
world,
yes.
or the black market,
mm-hmm.
or other things as well.
Okay.
So therefore, there are some people. There's a difference of opinion.
Mm-hmm.
The difference of opinion itself is not a bad thing. The problem is how to tackle this difference of opinion.
Mm-hmm.
The respect of difference of opinion, if it is really a difference of opinion, and it's because of something which is really based on some knowledge or theory, then obviously there is an answer for it.
Okay.
And we should answer it according to the, like, you know, logically you should answer it, and within the educated, you know, the within the premises of an education, or, you know, scholarly answers should be given to the difference of opinion. But when this difference of opinion gets involved into, you know, rationalism, for example, it gets involved into the people's sensation, or, you know, their relations towards a specific thing, then obviously it gets, you know, rational, it gets something which is dangerous. And then people do not have any respect of each other. And on your first question, I have an objection that when you started with the Islam, that some people takfir and some people do not do that, it is generally in the world. Don't just give an example of Islam, because
the picture which is shown out of the religion of Islam.
The problem is, it is in every religion. It is even those who are not following religion, they also have this thing.
Okay.
They also have this, this extremism in
mm-hmm.
themselves. For example, if we talk about the Zionist regime, if you talk about their system, you know how they're talking about the countries who are talking against them. You cannot talk about the Holocaust on the media. You cannot talk against the system or do any action.
That's right.
Or, you know, even the freedom of speech
yes.
is not the freedom in a way it should in the West. You know, they stop you, they kick you out if you are an anchor or maybe a radio, we can say like a producer or
especially
anything.
The cancel society, you know, they're becoming snowflakes.
Especially the experts of the radio shows.
So it's everywhere. It's not about the Islam itself. Come on. The question is wrong. I just oppose the question that you put on.
This is everywhere, but the case is that why?
Islamophobia is another fact.
Because
they're doing that because of Islamophobia. They want
why Islam is shown as a non-tolerant one?
Well, because Islam is the perfect religion, and the other religions, because they're not answerable to the needs of the people, and obviously they cannot
there's
take.
There's also that self-pride that the Muslims have. That pride, you know, al-izz. You know, that pride that Muslims have, where you know we know ourselves, we have that confidence of our religion, unlike some other religions. I was actually surprised when I was debating the other day. You know, it was like not debating; I was just asking questions about with Jewish people actually, and they were kind of, you know, I felt them; they were shaking when they were talking, and they're like, "Oh, we're not sure, we're not certain, I don't know." And at the end of the day, I felt that when you talk to a Muslim, he talks with so much belief. Is it because of them being from the Middle East? We have that much confidence. But then I said, no, this person is a Jewish person, lives in Palestine, nowadays Palestine.
Yes, yes.
And now that he was talking, you know, first with confidence, then when I started asking about his beliefs in God and the attributes of God and stuff like that, he became shaky. And I haven't seen religion, you know, with such confidence when it brings up its beliefs other than Islam. And I believe that Al-Azzatu Lillah, Alhamdulillah wa Shukr, you know, it's strange to the Muslims.
I think we have in Surah Hujurat, ayah 13, that we have created you from different nations and tribes in order to identify. The purpose is in order to identify and know each other better, isn't it? So this difference of opinions, races, languages.
Difference of opinions. I said it before that the lifestyles differ. You know, there's this saying I've been looking for a long time. And the story of me reading it is a very nice story, actually. I was going to a majlis, and then all of a sudden I went into the Marashi Najafi library. It's a long story short. I opened the book, and the first thing that came up to my eyes was that the way that the imam used to respect people who were from more outside the Arab lands, the Persians, it was different from the ways that he would respect the people from the Arab lands. It really just popped up to my mind that there are some, you know, let's say notions, ideas that, for example, in the Arabic, if you stand up, it's a sign of respect. Kissing the hand is a sign of respect for the knowledgeers and scholars. In the West, for example, it's kind of a respect that you don't stand up. Because if you stand up, it's kind of like you're scared of him. Right?
Yes.
The way that you greet, like shaking the hands, sometimes it's two kisses, sometimes it's three kisses. Are you two kisser or three kisser?
Three kisses. During pandemic, non-kisses.
Not non-kisses.
Non-kisses.
During pandemic.
We are huggers. So whenever we are getting to a party in Iran, you know, we have to kiss and shake hands with all the men over there.
No problem. Yeah. Look, what I want to say here is that there are different ethics.
Okay.
Cultures.
Etiquettes.
You know, the food that we eat really just displays that this effort, different ethics, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and I realized this when my friend married a Syrian woman, right? He said, Habib, I can't live with her anymore. I told him why. He said that she doesn't make any rice. She only makes sandwiches.
Oh.
Yeah, they eat so little rice. They don't eat any rice. It's from our culture that we eat rice. And that really just shows you that the difference of culture, how it is. And that really just shows you that the difference of our opinions, even though they are different to some extent, at the end of the day, there might be, you know, those larger notions of respect, of humbleness.
Yes.
The way that being humble, what the Prophet did, is different than the way of being humble, for example, in the Arab manner is different than the way of being humble in the American manner, for example. And, you know, even the FBI have this. I seen it on YouTube, actually. Okay. And the way that you hold flowers is different. You hold flowers because in society it's rude to hold flowers like this, so you hold it the opposite manner in Eastern Europe.
Thank you, my Said Mohsen and Brother Habib, for your presence in the program. Viewpoints on Difference of Opinion. It was very kind of you. And thank you, Mashdi listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstory.com/ and Call of Islam page, also YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Mm-hmm.
the same. When I'm too concerned by what they say, why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest night, shows me right from wrong, world that often lies. As I don't need anyone, anything in life, but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Israel is widely viewed as a destabilizing force in the West Asia region. It has started many wars over the past decades against regional nations. The occupying regime's hostile actions are unending. Right now, it is enforcing its expansionist policies in occupied Palestinian territories by building on lands that the international community insists must be given back to the Palestinians. The regime has gained notoriety for committing crimes of apartheid against the Palestinian people on a very large scale. Parts of Syrian and Lebanese territories are also occupied by Israel. The regime routinely carries out airstrikes against Syrian army positions. Among other destabilizing Israeli actions in the region are high-profile assassinations of top nuclear scientists in Iran and sabotage operations against Iranian nuclear energy facilities. The lists of Israel's destabilizing activities and crimes seem endless. Despite the regime's record, some regional states have been getting close to it. The United Arab Emirates seems to be leading the way. The UAE normalized ties with Israel in September 2020 as part of a U.S.-backed initiative that also includes Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. Days ago, Israeli President Isaac Herzog made his first visit to the UAE more than a month after Naftali Bennett became the first Israeli prime minister to visit the country. The president of the regime, widely blamed for regional insecurity in the most volatile part of the world, said ironically that Israel supports the Emirates' security needs.
So it's like bringing the fox in to protect the chicken house. That's not going to work. You let them in, they take over. If you want a good example, look at what happened to the Catholic Church when they signed an agreement with Israel. Israel got everything it wanted, and they never fulfilled one of the obligations that they said they would fulfill. And the situation for Christians in Israel is worse now than before they signed that agreement.
During his visit to the UAE, Herzog discussed security and bilateral ties with Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. Sheikh Mohammed said Israel and the UAE share a, quote, common view of the threats to regional stability and peace. Israel is notorious for creating insecurity in the West Asia region. Why are some Arab countries getting close to the regime and claim they want to enhance security? A few days after Herzog's visit, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian issued a stark warning about the Israeli regime's presence in the region. In a phone call with Emirati Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation, Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan, Amir Abdullahian described Israel as a quote-unquote threat to all regional countries, urging efforts to prevent those who create tensions from gaining a foothold there. What would be the consequence of the Israeli regime gaining a stronger foothold in the region? Palestinian resistance group Hamas has also reacted to Herzog's visit. It said such visits encourage the occupation to continue escalating its aggression against the Palestinian people and denial of their rights. The Palestinians, who already face an uphill battle against the occupation, have described the normalization as a stab in the back. The equation in the region has become increasingly complex, keeping observers guessing how it will evolve.
For centuries, Iran was governed by monarchies and autocratic rulers, and the last dynasty to rule was founded by Reza Shah Pahlavi in 1925. During his reign that lasted for 16 years, Reza Shah replaced Islamic laws with Western ones as part of reforms that drew public discontent. In 1941, he was forced to abdicate the throne to his son, Mohammad Reza. The new Shah maintained a close relationship with the U.S. His government was known for its autocracy and focus on westernization, as well as a disregard for religious and democratic measures in Iran's constitution. Mohammad Reza Shah was largely criticized for political corruption and the oppression committed by his secret police, known as Savak. He established the service with help from Israel and the CIA, its main aim to monitor opponents and repress dissent. Savak's practice of torture and executions of the regime's opponents made it the most notorious and feared institution in Iran prior to the Islamic Revolution. In 1963, the Shah launched a series of reforms known as the White Revolution. Although the reforms brought some progress to Iran, they were met with a strong criticism from the public. The opposition to Shah and his White Revolution was spearheaded by Ayatollah Khomeini, a prominent religious figure who believed the Shah had embarked on a path toward the destruction of Islam. In June of that year, Imam Khomeini delivered his famous sermon at Fazia Seminary, where he strongly criticized the Shah's policies. After that speech, he was arrested, and that sparked 3 days of mass rallies nationwide, with his supporters saying 15,000 people were killed by police. After spending 8 months under house arrest, Imam Khomeini was released. But he remained a strong and outspoken critic of the Shah regime for its policies, including its close cooperation with Israel. In November 1964, Imam Khomeini was rearrested and sent into exile for another 15 years. But popular support for him grew even further during his absence. Opposition to the Pahlavi regime continued to spread, with Iranians outraged at a high inflation rate, a widening gap between rich and poor, and the repression of freedom of speech. Anger was also high at the royal family benefiting the most from the country's oil revenues at a time when thousands of poor people were suffering under austerity measures to curb the inflation. Popular rage was further ignited by the death of Imam Khomeini's son Mustafa at the hands of Savak. His death on October 23, 1977, set off a chain of mass demonstrations that grew in the months ahead and turned into a campaign of civil resistance. To appease the protesters, the Shah regime launched reforms and pledged to do more. However, none of those measures were welcome, with the protesters remaining steadfast as insisting that the monarchy must be overthrown and that Imam Khomeini should return home. The anti-Shah demonstrations started growing in their millions nationwide, despite a heavy-handed crackdown by the military. On January 16, 1979, the Shah and his family finally left Iran for Egypt. And nearly 2 weeks later, on February the 1st, Imam Khomeini returned to Tehran with a promise to form a government that would have popular support. On February the 11th, the Pahlavi regime was overthrown and the Islamic Revolution emerged victorious. And on April the 1st, Iran became an Islamic Republic in a referendum voted for by more than 98% of the electorate. The period from February the 1st to 11th is known as Dahi-e-Fajr, or the 10-day dawn in Iran. Every year, Iranians celebrate the Islamic revolution that brought an end to 2,500 years of monarchical rule in their country.
A spiritual leader who maintained a simple lifestyle. Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini was born in the city of Khomeini on September 24, 1902. He grew up in a family with a long tradition of religious scholarship. He received early Quranic education at home and local schools, and pursued his later studies at Islamic seminaries until he became marja, or a source of emulation, a highly prominent authority in religious law. Imam Khomeini soon rose to fame as an anti-imperialism and anti-colonialism icon. He became politically active when, in 1963, the then US-backed monarch of Iran, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, launched a program of reforms known as the White Revolution. The plan was an American-inspired package of measures designed to prop up the regime and nip any voices of dissent in the bud, all in the name of promoting the rights of citizens. Imam Khomeini was the first religious leader who openly condemned the Shah's program of westernization. That opposition led to protests against the monarch. In response, the Pahlavi regime launched a brutal crackdown and arrested Imam Khomeini. His detention resulted in an uprising in June 1963. Demonstrators were confronted by tanks and troops armed to the teeth. Thousands were killed. In November 1964, Imam Khomeini was rearrested and sent into exile, this time because he had opposed the legal immunity the Shah had granted to American military personnel in Iran. He spent over 14 years in exile, mostly in the holy city of Najaf in Iraq. But that didn't stop him from criticizing the Shah for making concessions to Western powers, in his view, a violation of Iranian sovereignty. People from all walks of life listened to his speeches via cassettes and distributed his letters, which became the bedrock of a budding revolution. In the early 1970s, Imam Khomeini gave a series of lectures in Najaf on the establishment of a system based on Islamic values. Those lectures were later published as a book under the title Guardianship of the Islamic Jurists. This was his most famous and influential work. It laid out his ideas on a system of governance that would end dictatorship, establish Sharia or Islam's divine law, and would fight injustice, corruption, and oppression. Imam Khomeini's courage, charisma, and popularity opened a new chapter in a grassroots resistance against the Pahlavi regime. Ultimately, on the 16th of January, 1979, the Shah fled Iran, and on February the 1st, Imam Khomeini returned from Neufeld Le Chateau in France, where he'd been living in exile. 10 days later, Iranians celebrated as their revolution culminated in the overthrow of the US-backed Pahlavi regime. In March 1979, more than 98% of Iranians voted in favor of an Islamic Republic in a referendum. Under such a system proposed by Imam Khomeini, Iran is considered a sovereign country in the form of a republic that implements Islamic laws. A system in marked contrast to the dictatorial Pahlavi regime that was totally dependent on the West, in particular the United States.
Back in 2013, when AFRICOM was first established, only two African countries showed a willingness to host American bases. But now, even South Africa, which once led a campaign against American intervention on the continent, has hosted drills with the US. But that's a cause of concern, particularly considering the spike in coup attempts in West and East Africa, areas that host the largest concentration of US bases. At least seven coups over the past 13 years have reportedly involved troops trained under AFRICOM. Last week, a Pentagon report suggested a 70% annual increase in violent events linked to militant groups in the Sahel region. According to the data, last year, attacks across the region jumped from 1,180 to at least 2,005, the most dramatic hike on the continent. Those attacks have killed an estimated 4,800 people last year, accounting for some two-thirds of the total number of terror attack victims in Africa.
Well, I think the U.S. is very much afraid of Africa becoming, the countries of Africa working together and becoming a powerhouse that would be able to rival the United States and rival Western Europe. Because you have to think about it, Africa is a very, very big continent, which much bigger than the United States, with a lot more valuable resources in this modern age. So I think the United States is afraid.
The U.S. maintains its military presence in Africa under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but human rights groups say civilians have been caught in the crossfire and casualties from U.S. airstrikes are higher than have been reported. The United States' increased foothold in Africa has raised concerns, as the country hasn't had a good track record even when it comes to delivering on its stated claims of fighting terrorism. Take Somalia, for example, where the U.S. has been conducting airstrikes against al-Shabaab terrorists for a decade. Despite the U.S. attacks, al-Shabaab has proven resilient and is still able to carry out high-profile attacks in the country and neighboring states such as Kenya. In addition, rights groups have long accused AFRICOM of shrouding its operations in secrecy and denying accountability for the civilians killed in its airstrikes. The United States has failed to provide an accurate tally of equipment and resources it has sent to U.S. Africa Command partner nations in its most recent audit. That has raised concerns that the equipment might have fallen to the wrong hands.
So the United States, by picking up this banner that the United Kingdom, the British Empire, left, has basically realized the most effective way to combat any sort of rise of anti-imperialism or any sort of self-determination for these colonized, these exploited countries, is by, instead of just launching a full-out invasion of U.S. forces, that the intelligence agencies should begin covertly funding and fostering organizations that will have inner conflict between the main group, in the case of Mau Mau, by supporting a counter game.
What the U.S. needs to keep in mind when making decisions about investing militarily in Africa is the outcome of its 20-year-long war in Afghanistan, as all the American lives lost and all the funds spent there turn out to be for nothing.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Imam Khomeini and his personal life. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the personal life of Imam Khomeini, the aspect of his personal life. What we can see is that Imam Khomeini was performing all his things by himself. Even if he wanted a glass of water, he used to take water by himself. He never asked it from his wife or the children. So he used to do everything by himself. And his family, they said that even if he wanted a cup of tea, he used to go and make tea for himself and used to bring tea for us as well. Therefore, he was very much bound to the level that if he can perform anything by his hands or himself, he used to do it without asking others, and without disturbing others. And he wasn't a person who used to order people in the house. He used to do it by himself. Therefore, his children has said that we haven't seen our father ordering us to, for example, bring water, do this, do that. No, not like this. He wasn't like this. He was a person who was very much humble, who was very much bound to the Islamic teachings, who was very much loving, and he used to take care of everyone in the house. And this was how Imam Khomeini, in his personal life, when we look at his life within the house, he was very much caring and loving person.
Congratulations to all Muslims across the world on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Listen to our special programs on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the personal aspect of the life of Imam Khomeini, and we said that he used to perform everything by himself, and he never asked others to do the things which he wanted. So his own works, he used to do it. And we can see that, for example, Hajj Mustafa, his son, he said that, "I never saw my father ordering me." And even once I remember that once he needed a pen and paper, and it was on the second floor. So when he wanted it, he searched for it and he couldn't find it. And he asked me, "Where is the pen and paper?" I said, "It is on the second floor." Therefore, he went up by himself and brought it without asking me to go up and bring it. Therefore, his son says, "I never remember that he has ordered me." On the other hand, we have other stories about his life where he went to the ziyarah of Imam Rada alayhi salam in Mashhad, where they were staying at a hotel, and the companions of Imam, they asked him to go for the ziyarat when they reached after they had the dinner and the tea. So Imam Khomeini has said them, like, "You guys should go. I need some rest, and I will visit the shrine later." So the companions, they went, and when they came back, they saw that Imam Khomeini by himself has washed all the dishes, and he had prepared tea for his companions or the friends. When they came back, he served them with that tea. And this shows us that he was very much concerned about his personal life, about the people who were around him, so that they are not feeling any hardship because of him at that point. And this is a lesson to learn, that we should also apply these things in our life if we want to have an Islamic lifestyle, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allah, 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 Allah.
إِنَّ الَّذِينَ قَالُوا رَبُّنَا اللَّهُ ثُمَّ اسْتَقَامُوا تَتَنَزَّلُ عَلَيْهِمُ الْمَلَائِكَةُ.
Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
It can't be emphasized enough just how many taxpayer dollars are now being showered on the Pentagon, says William Harting, journalist in an article titled $778 billion and counting. Who is paying for all this Pentagon waste? Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. '21 was another banner year for the military-industrial complex as U.S. Congress signed off on a new record $778 billion in spending for the Pentagon and related work on nuclear warheads at the Department of Energy. That was $25 billion more than the Pentagon had even asked for. It can't be emphasized enough just how many taxpayer dollars are now being showered on a Pentagon. That department's astronomical budget adds up, for instance, to more than four times the cost of the most recent version of Biden's Build Back Better plan, which sparked such horrified opposition from Senator Joe Manchin and other alleged fiscal conservatives. Naturally, they didn't blink when it came to lavishing ever more taxpayer dollars on the military-industrial complex. Opposing Build Back Better while throwing so much more money at the Pentagon marks the ultimate in budgetary and national security hypocrisy. The Congressional Budget Office has determined that if current trends continue, the Pentagon could receive a monumental $7.3 trillion plus over the next decade, more than was spent during the peak decade of the Afghan and Iraq wars, when there were up to 190,000 American troops in those countries alone. Sadly, all too periodically, Biden's decision to withdraw U.S. troops and contractors from Afghanistan hasn't generated even the slightest peace dividend. Instead, any savings from that war are already being plowed into programs to counter China, official Washington's budget-justifying threat of choice. And all of this despite the fact that the United States already spends three times as much as China on its military. The Pentagon budget is not only gargantuan, but replete with waste, from vast overcharges for spare parts to weapons that don't work at unaffordable prices to forever wars with immense human and economic consequences. Simply put, the current level of Pentagon spending is both unnecessary and irrational. Overcharging the Pentagon for spare parts has a long and inglorious history, reaching its previous peak of public visibility during the presidency of Ronald Reagan in 1980s. Then, blanket media coverage of $640 toilet seats and $7,600 coffee makers sparked public outrage and a series of hearings on Capitol Hill, strengthening the backbone of members of Congress. In those years, they did indeed curb at least the worst excesses of the Reagan military build-up. Such pricing horror stories didn't emerge from thin air. They came from the work of people like legendary Pentagon whistleblower Ernest Fitzgerald. He initially made his mark by exposing the Air Force's efforts to hide billions in cost overruns on Lockheed massive C-5A transport plane. At the time, he was described by former Air Force Secretary Warren Orr as the most hated man in the Air Force. Fitzgerald and other Pentagon insiders became sources for Dina Razor, a young journalist who began drawing the attention of the media and congressional representatives to spare parts overcharges and other military horrors. In the end, she formed an organization, the Project on Military Procurement, to investigate and expose waste fraud and abuse. It will later evolve into the Project on Government Oversight, or POGO, the most effective current watchdog when it comes to Pentagon spending. A recent POGO analysis, for instance, documented the malfeasance of Transdigm, a military parts supplier that the Department of Defense's Inspector General caught overcharging the Pentagon by as much as 3,800%. Yes, you read that figure right. On routine items. The company was able to do so only because, bizarrely enough, Pentagon buying rules prevent contract officers from getting accurate information on what any given item should cost or might cost the supplying company to produce it. The next level of Pentagon waste involves weapons they don't need at prices they can't afford, systems that, for staggering sums, fail to deliver on promises to enhance the safety and security of Americans. The poster child for such costly, dysfunctional systems is F-35 combat aircraft, a plane tasked with multiple missions, none of which it does well. The Pentagon is slated to buy more than 2,400 F-35s for the Air Force, Marines, and Navy. The estimated lifetime cost for procuring and operating those planes, a mere $1.7 trillion, would make it the Pentagon's most expensive weapons project ever. Once upon a time, as in some fairy tale, the idea behind the creation of F-35 was to build a plane that, in several variations, would be able to carry out many different tasks relatively cheaply, with potential savings generated by economies of scale. Theoretically, that meant the bulk of the parts for the thousands of planes to be built would be the same for all of them. This approach has proven a dismal failure so far, so much so that the researchers at POGO are convinced that the F-35 may never be fully ready for combat. And its failures are too numerous to recount here. But a few examples should suffice to suggest why the program minimally needs to be scaled back in a major way, if not canceled completely. For a start, though meant to provide air support for troops on the ground, is proved anything but well designed to do so. In fact, that job is already handled far better and more cheaply by existing A-10 Warthog attack aircraft. A 2021 Pentagon assessment of the F-35, and keep in mind that this is the Department of Defense, not same outside expert, found 800 unresolved defects in the plane. Typical of its never-ending problems, a widely expensive and not particularly functional high-tech helmet, which at a cost of $400,000 each, is meant to give its pilot a special awareness of what's happening around and below the plane as well as to the horizon. And don't forget that the F-35 will be staggeringly expensive to maintain and already cost an impressive $38,000 an hour to fly.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah.
have gathered here freely, and freely you are propounding political and social issues vital to the nation. You are not the ladies of a few years ago. Today you are having a say in your destiny. You are propounding political issues and are making demands of the government. This is the meaning of freedom. January 3rd, 1979.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Today we are with another program of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio, and I'm your host Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Islamic Revolution. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has mentioned that Iran preserved its revolution by the hand of the faithful, and it is advancing by the same hands even now. Now, in this part of speech, Imam Khomeini is referring to an important point which is being said in Quran many times, because even in the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about the mu'mineen, the faithful ones, the believers, and he talks about muttaqun, the God-fearing ones. So this is important, that when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has put victory in the hands of mu'mineen, in the hands of the faithful ones, therefore if there is any revolution which has happened by the hands of the faithful, and if the next generation who is preserving or who's advancing and on whose home's hands is this revolution, if they are also faithful, therefore this revolution will advance.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi.
Sallallahu alayhi.
Salli
ala Rasulullah.
We know that the Imam of the Faithfuls, the leader of the Faithfuls, is Amirul Mu'mineen. Amirul Mu'mineen, the leader of faithful. This is what Amirul Mu'mineen means. So when the people who are the follower of the leader of the faithful, and they're faithful by themselves, obviously, and they are purely following the footsteps of Imam Ali alayhi salam, therefore we can see that this country, this place where these faithful people live, obviously they have done this revolution in order to bring justice in the society, in order to bring justice in the society. Now this is very important, because if justice is there, then obviously people will have a happy life. Although there are many attacks by the enemies, it can be like through the internet, through the media, through the like the soft war or the hard war, it has faced everything. But the thing which has saved this revolution and the next generation who is advancing this revolution are all faithful, and this is the fact why Iran is still advancing in the technology, in the medical sciences, in the economy, in the political system, in all aspects of the life when we look at it. And this is because this is in the hands of the faithful ones.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
www.parstoday.com/en.